It's kind of an odd thing for someone who spent 11 years as a language professor to realize that in eternity, there's not going to be much need for my profession. Because when all is said and done, the curse that was placed on earth at Babel is destined to be undone. And people will again be able to communicate freely because language will not be used at cross purposes with God. When man raises up his head and wants to go in his direction, God can introduce difficulties that man never anticipated. We read in 2 Thessalonians about the restraining ministry that now prevents the man of sin from being revealed. Well, God has been in the business of restraining that which would go contrary to his purposes ever since history began. In fact, even before history began, God has been an expert in this field. As we think about language, I am reminded about two examples from my own family as well as my own history. My grandfather, my maternal grandfather, spoke Finnish as his language as a child. And he got on the boat, and that was the first place that he ever had any lessons in English as he was heading across the ocean. So as you can imagine, he came into, actually, Canada. He was refused entrance into the United States, and that's kind of an interesting story. So he went into Canada and had a pocket knife and a fish hook and worked his way across from eastern Canada clear to Ontario. And then one moonless night, someone rowed him across the Rainy River, and he walked another 100 miles to Mountain Iron, Minnesota, where his family lived, and eventually became an American citizen. A very interesting thing happened. He learned how to speak English. He was rather fluent in English at the time of his death, but he had a couple of strokes, and there was an interesting thing that would happen about 24 hours before he would have a stroke. He would not be able to communicate in English anymore, and all of a sudden, all he could speak in was Finnish. Very interesting, some of the things that can happen with regard to language. People couldn't get over. Why is it that all he's doing is speaking in Finnish? My mother had a stroke that affected her speech as well. Well, her speech came back, and she was able to converse and so forth, but she was having a hard time drawing upon the words that she wanted to use. And so she started doing all kinds of crossword puzzles and playing Scrabble, and in the process of that, started developing her ability to draw upon words once again. Now for the example concerning myself. You know, I have a little bit of a reputation around here as being a language person, but in one sense, I'm kind of a failure with regard to languages. Let me explain. When I was in public schools, I studied Spanish, and I got to the point where I was reading textbooks written in Spanish. In fact, I took U.S. history taught in Spanish one year. I got to university, and I decided to start improving my Finnish. So I took Finnish studies university. And so I did that for a couple of years. And I corresponded with a distant cousin of mine in Finland and would tell him about Jesus Christ. So he would write to me in English and I would write to him in Finnish. Well, then after I finished university, I decided to study Greek, Hebrew, and so I studied both of them and then went to seminary and continued studying them and added Aramaic And then when I started working on my doctoral program, I needed to learn French and German. And along the way, I learned some Latin. Well, you know, the interesting thing is, guess how many languages I can converse in? One. So despite having, I think that's 8 foreign languages that I can read, I can only converse in one language. So in a sense, I am a failure with regard to languages. And the problem that happened at the Tower of Babel is that people were confronted with new languages as adults. And adults have a terrible time learning to speak in foreign languages. They had a tremendous difficulty communicating with one another. Well, let's see how we got to this point in Genesis. So let's back up a little bit and let's consider the Toledotes. These are the generations that we have within the book of Genesis. That's the arrangement around which the whole book is set up. In the Old King James, these are the generations of, these are the generations of, these are the generations of. And we have seen how that works very much like a statement of, you know what became of so-and-so? When you're at a high school reunion and the little kid that he couldn't imagine would do anything became just this husky person and became not a major league player, but you know, became something. He isn't that famous because it was a surprise to you when you heard about him. Well, what happens in the book of Genesis is we start with small beginnings, and then out of those statements we find out what developed. Now, the first of the Toledotes doesn't actually have the word Toledot, and as you remember, Toledot means generations. So these are the generations of. The first statement, there is the summary statement in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There was a problem. What was the problem? The earth was, okay, it was void, but it was formless and void. And so days 1 through 3 dealt with what problem? Formlessness, and days 4 through 6 dealt with voidness. What did God do on the seventh day? He rested. He was tired. No. He rested because his works were done. Did that mean that the earth was filled with people? No. Well, wait a moment. I thought he filled it. Well, what he did was he put in place people, enough people to be able to have a population explosion. The same with various land animals, sea creatures, and birds. And so days 5 and 6 were the starting of a process, but God had accomplished everything that he needed in order that earth could go forth no matter what happened in the garden. Second Toledot, though, starts us with a recap of day number 6. In the sixth day, we have a statement that shows up that's in contrast with what was said about the sixth day the first time. And that was that it was very good. What was in contrast with it was very good? Not good that man should be alone. Why isn't it good that man should be alone? Can't fill the earth with people if he doesn't have a wife. So early in the sixth day, after creating Adam, God said the first time he pronounced not good, it was because until there was a helper corresponding to him, there would be no way that the earth could be filled. And since creation was designed to resolve formless and voidness, the earth needed to be filled for earth to become good. So, God set Adam out there as part of his job of tending the garden to name all the animals. And as he did so, what did he observe? He saw that there were two of each kind. And so he started observing that, hey, wait a moment, what about me? And God came to his rescue and created the woman and brought her to him. Now, things are starting out really wonderful, but you know, all the Toledotes through the rest of the book end up on kind of a sour note. You put man into the equation, and before you know it, what God has done that's very good ends up going downhill. What was the problem that happened in Genesis chapter 3? God had given man a choice. Eat of this tree, eat of that tree, or boycott them both. And for a while, it seems that they boycotted both of the trees. After a while, serpent said, hey, you know, this is a nice tree over here. And before you know it, the woman was eating, and so was the man. And they had been told that in the day that they ate of it, dying, they would die. Death was the consequence of that sin. The whole human race was plunged into death. Now we notice that with regard to the tree that was set there in the garden, the tree of the knowledge, the tree of life, God prevented the man and the woman after they had sinned from having access to that tree. What would have been the consequence if they had eaten of that tree? Okay, let's look. Genesis chapter 3, verse 22. Then the Lord God said, behold, the man has become like one of us, to know good and evil. And now lest he put out his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever. So God doesn't want man to live forever, does he? Okay, no, that's not the problem. The problem here is that without dealing with sin, God would be forced to keep the terms of the promise. And it was important that God resolve the problem of sin as he brings about solution to everlasting life. Now, please observe. Doesn't this verse tell us that Adam and Eve did not possess everlasting life at this time? If they ate of it, they would live forever. So if they didn't eat of it, isn't the implication they wouldn't live forever? Now, everlasting life is everlasting. If you have it, you're going to have it forever. If you could lose it, it wouldn't be everlasting, would it? So this tells us that at the point that the man and the woman were put into the garden, they lacked everlasting life. They possessed life, but they lacked everlasting life. They were plunged into death, dying, you shall die, the day that you eat of the tree. God still wants to give them everlasting life, and we saw that both the man, in terms of how it is that he named his wife, he named her Hava, life, because she was the mother of all living. But that was before she had any children. And Hava, Eve, was expecting that her firstborn was the promised seed of woman. Both the man and the woman show themselves to have understood God's promise of life. They were both believers. And they received everlasting life through God's new promise, through the seed of woman promise that he had made for them both and for the rest of humanity. Well, we think, you know, things are pretty bad here with the fall. Having a death sentence being put upon the whole earth, it's pretty bad news, right? But in chapter 4, what do we see? Cain murders Abel. And then in chapters 5 and 10, we have genealogies. And in those genealogies, what do we see? So-and-so was born, He lived so long, he had so many children, and he died. One exception, Enoch. But otherwise, you look at a genealogy and the high point is birth and death. Death is a very prominent feature within the book of Genesis, as is life. We get to Genesis chapter 6, and there was an angelic infiltration into the human race that threatened the promise that God had made. It had threatened the purity of the seed. It threatened the promise of life. God gave men 120 years, and during that 120 years before the judgment, Noah built the ark. And we saw then how God very carefully brought about the deliverance through the ark. After man has come out of the ark, God makes promises. One of those promises was that he would never again flood the earth. Now, when he flooded the earth, remember what it was that he said. He repented that he had created men. But rather than destroying all of humanity, God spared Noah and his immediate family so that they could, in a sense, start out like a new Adam. But it doesn't take long, and there are problems introduced. Noah plants his garden, and in the garden he has a vineyard, and maybe 4 years, 5 years after the flood is over, Noah gets drunk. And in the process of him getting drunk, we saw last week that one of the sons, Ham, saw the nakedness of Noah. What does the nakedness of Noah mean? Well, let's see another passage written by the same author in the book of Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 18. The question arises, who is it that Ham saw naked? And it's slightly ambiguous. I have a definite opinion as to which way the ambiguity is to be resolved. Notice Leviticus chapter 18, verse 8. The nakedness of your father's wife you shall not uncover. It is your father's nakedness. So is Noah's nakedness his own nakedness or his wife's nakedness? I would suggest that it very likely was his wife's, that is, Ham's mother. Now we think about God brought a universal flood because of the potential of the contamination of the seed line through which seed of woman is going to come. What happens if incest gets going in the human race within the line of the seed? There would be a tremendous problem once again. God places a judgment, and the judgment is placed on the lineage of one of the sons. And that was the son named Canaan. Now, we observed a little problem, and that is that when one reads a couple of verses in Genesis, it appears because Canaan is the last son mentioned, that he might have been the last son born. But we saw that genealogies recorded by Moses, quite often put the most important son first, and birth order is not necessarily suggested. I would argue that Canaan was probably the only son that was alive at this point. And the curse was placed on him, God knowing that the awfulness of what was going to characterize the Canaanites. And they were excluded from being owners, having title deed to the land of Israel. We have seen that Genesis chapter 10, the table of nations, is showing the countries with which Israel could enter into covenant and the ones that they should not. In particular, they should not enter into covenant with the line of Canaan. Very much, God is preparing a people who are being led by Moses to go into the promised land as to who it is that is under God's blessing, who it is that's under God's cursing, so that they can know how to approach other people as they enter the land. Well, now we get to Genesis chapter 11, and we find another great judgment. Let's think about it. Have there not been judgments already in the book of Genesis? When Cain murdered Abel, there was not capital punishment, but a mark was placed on him that we would argue was grace, so that he would not be exterminated by someone else. We see in Genesis 6 through 8, the flood, as man is seeking to, or as angels are seeking to infiltrate the human race. Genesis chapter 9, God judged Canaan because of the frivolity with regard to sexual matters that had been characterized in Ham's dealing with his parents. Now in Genesis chapter 11, man is going to be threatening to be able to create a great evil upon the earth. And as God looks upon man and sees that he's going to be able to carry out great evil, he thwarts that plan. He puts a judgment upon them. Now, I'd like to show the structure of the passage here, and you have this in your notes as well as we can look at it here. There is a great chiasm that characterizes the first nine verses of Genesis chapter 11. Notice the A point. The whole earth had one language. And then God, in the A prime point, confused the language of the whole earth. The point B, they dwelt there, that is, in the land of Shinar. But then, point B prime, the Lord scattered them from there. He removed the people from that area. As they are there in the land, point C, they said to one another. And point C prime, everyone, the language of his neighbor shows up. Point D, come let us make bricks, and notice, come let us confuse. Now you might look at that and say, how are those two related? I am sure glad you asked. Look on your notes and you see that thing that looks like an X with a vertical line going through it? The word for making bricks, these are apparently white bricks. It's from the verb laban. And so it's a root that has the meaning of white. But anyway, laban, make bricks. Okay, you turn laban around, put the N at the beginning, the L in the middle, and the B at the front. Go down to verse 7. Come, let us confuse. So there is a play on words that Laban and Balan, Laban is to make bricks and Balan is to confuse. So you may have wondered, why is it that the big point is made, let's make bricks? Well, it is the wording that God picked up upon for saying he was going to undo their brick-making processes. That factory went into chaos. And then the point E, let's make for ourselves. And make is the key word, and the city that the people made or built is being picked up on, and so forth. So you notice how throughout the passage, Moses is being very careful to structure it in such a way that he shows that each and every point that was done was counterpointed by God. But what is the central point, the one that is unrepeated? The Lord came down to see. So God saw the way that things were going on there on the plain of Shinar. Well, let's get into new material. In 11:1, we have a statement that humanity was united by a single language. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. Now, we talked a little bit about the chronological relationship between chapters 10 and 11, but it's been a little while since we were in chapter 10. As if you remember, the way that we dealt with chapter 10 was I talked about all the genealogies in Genesis in one message. Put them all together. Some of them are of different types. Genesis 10 is one that's focused upon national entities, whereas most of the other genealogies that we have in the book of Genesis are focused on a lineage that has inheritance rights. But we have a very interesting verse that I'd like to call attention to in chapter 10, verse 25. Because, before we do that, let me point something out. That Genesis chapter 11, where you have the confusion of the languages, necessarily happens after three verses, or rather, necessarily happens before three verses in Genesis chapter 10. Look at Genesis 10:5, and then we'll look at 10:20 and 10:31. Let me give you a little bit of an orientation. Look at verse 2 of chapter 10. Notice the sons of Japheth. Remember, there were three sons of Noah. There's Japheth, there's Ham, and there's Shem. So the sons of Japheth were Gomer and so on and so forth, and that goes down through verse 5. So verses 2 through 5 are focusing on the lineage of Japheth. Now look at chapter 10, verses 6 through 20. This is focusing on the lineage of Ham. And then verses 21 and following deal with the lineage of Shem. So within each of those three lineages, we're going to have a capsulizing statement. Notice the statement at 10:5. From these, the coastland peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language. Now look at 11:1. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. Okay, do you see the chronological issue here? Verse 5 is talking about an event that happened after chapter 11. Now, we've seen that in Genesis, we regularly get flashbacks, don't we? And that's a standard feature of Genesis. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, and then it tells us about some background events. And so you can't go through Genesis and just assume everything's lined up first, second, third, fourth, fifth. So chapter 11 didn't happen after chapter 10 was finished. We'll find out where it fits in the passage. Notice then chapter 10, verse 20. These were the sons of Ham, according to their families, according to their languages, in their lands and in their nations. Okay, and look at 10:31. These were the sons of Shem, according to their families, according to their languages, in their lands, according to their nations. Well, we have a verse that's going to help us, I think, pin this down very nicely in chapter 10. And it's given to us within the lineage of Shem. Look at verse 25. To Eber were born two sons. The first The name of one was Peleg. Now, wouldn't that be a nice name for a son, Peleg? Well, it means division. For in his days, the earth was divided. Pray tell, what kind of division would Moses be talking about? Chapter 11, the division into different languages. So, let's see if we can put the chronology into a way that will make sense. You'll notice the chart that's there on page 2. We have an abbreviated genealogy. I haven't attempted to link who would correspond in Japheth's line or Ham's line, because we don't know how long generations took. You know, it can be different between the three families. So we can't say, oh, we go down so many generations in the family of Shem and we can figure out where it's going to correspond in Japheth's line or where it's going to correspond in Ham's line. But notice, if we look at Noah's lineage through Shem, we have Shem, Arphaxad, Shelah, Eber, Peleg, Reu, Serug, Nahor, and Terah. And during Peleg's lifetime, the earth was divided. What division has he talked about here within this section? Language is the division that he's talked about. Well, as you look at those sons here on the lineage of Shem, we can do that in a genealogy that's a linear genealogy, not a national-based genealogy, if we look in chapter 11. Look at chapter 11, starting with verse 10. This is the genealogy of Shem. Shem was 100 years old, and he begot Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. So 2 years after the flood, we have Arphaxad born. Okay, let's ignore the rest of verse 11, and then let's go to verse 12. Arphaxad lived 35 years and begot Salah. So you add 2 years plus 35 years, we got 37 years. Okay, skip verse 13. Go verse 14. Salah lived 30 years and begot Eber. So 37 plus 30 equals 67. Skip verse 15. Go to verse 16. Eber lived 34 years and begot Peleg. So we're now at 101 years. So Peleg was born 101 years after the flood. Now the problem is, Peleg lived a long time. Look at the next verse. Peleg lived 30 years and begot Reu. After he begot Reu, Peleg lived 209 years and begot sons and daughters. So we can say the flood happened precisely sometime during the 239 years that Peleg was alive. My, that's helpful. Well, yes, it is. Because in one sense, it might seem to be quite meaningless. It might not really help to narrow things down at all, because if you start looking at that genealogy, Shem was alive when Peleg was born, and Peleg was alive when Terah was born, so you've got lots and lots and lots and lots of people being overlapped. But I'm going to suggest something. When do you give people names or nicknames? It usually is going to happen when they're younger rather than when they're quite elderly. I think that the fact that Peleg is selected is saying, hey, you know, when he was a little whippersnapper, people couldn't talk to each other anymore. And my suggestion, for what it's worth, don't say, thus saith the Lord, but my suggestion, for what it's worth, it probably happened earlier in his life rather than later in his life. But it does seem that Peleg's name is a reference to the fact of the confusion of the languages. Okay, so we see verse 11, the existing status that we have after the flood, up until sometime while Peleg was alive, the earth was united with one language. Now, that brings us to verse 2. We have a group of migrating people, and so verses 2 through 4, upon reaching the land of Shinar, the inhabitants resolved to build a great city and a great tower to make a name for themselves that they might not be scattered. They did not want to be scattered. They're traveling, and they have arrived in the plain of Shinar, and they're saying, we need to do something. We need to stop this. We need to make it so that we won't be scattered. Now, why is it that they're worried about being scattered? Well, let's back up to Genesis chapter 9, verse 1. This is what God said once the flood has ended. So God blessed Noah and his sons, and he said to them, be fruitful and multiply and put down firm roots right here. Fill the earth. Well, how are they going to fill the earth if they don't migrate? If they just stay in one place and build it up into a great metropolis, are they going to be able to fill the earth? Okay, since you're wondering about the geography of this, the blue circle up here is the region of the mountains of Ararat, which is where the ark set down. It doesn't say specifically it was on Mount Ararat itself, but it was in the mountains, plural, of Ararat. And people have been dispersing, they've been moving around, they've been migrating into various places. Interestingly enough, we're told in the passage here that these people journeyed from the east. So they have been migrating, and they come from the east and end up in Shinar, in the area now of Babylon, which is in Iraq. So that's marked by the red circle. Just about the center of that is where Babel would be. So let's read the verses here, verses 2 through 4. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. So God has said, scatter, and they say, not on your life. We're going to put down firm roots. We're staying right here, and we're going to take steps to make it so that we can't be dispersed. And you know, God's kind of up for challenges like that. People shake their fist at God, and they say this, and they say that, and God says, oh, we'll see. And that's what he does here. He came and saw. Well, in verse 2, we have migrating peoples reaching the land of Shinar. They're migrating. That's saying that they're doing what God was wanting them to do, because Genesis 9:1 said for them to fill the earth. So we have people moving. They're on the move. They're migrating. And they said, "My, what a wonderful place." They might say, like I do when I go up to Minnesota, "This is God's country." Or as I was teasing Diane, that I said, "You want to come back to God's country? I'll meet you in God's country up in Sacramento." And I'll be meeting her on Monday. I'm not sure that she regards Sacramento as God's country, although I love the Central Valley, having grown up there. She looks at Oregon and says, "That seems more like God's country in a lot of ways." We all kind of have our places that we like and we favor over other places. And these people, they got there and they said, "Wow, this is a wonderful place. Let's stick around." So they're here, and they're not here temporarily as far as they are concerned. So in verse 3, they proposed making baked bricks. And you might say, "Well, what's the big point about bricks?" Well, we pointed out that the word for making bricks is a word that God is going to turn around, and he's going to say, instead of lavan, to make bricks, God says, "Let us confuse, balan." So he just turns the word around. Now, there is a reason that they would be making things out of bricks. In that particular area, clay is in abundance, and hard rocks for construction, granite and so on and so forth, are a little hard to come by. So you notice that the last part of it, it says they had brick for stone and had asphalt for mortar. They couldn't use the traditional building materials that would be used in a lot of other places. So they're going to be making this out of brick. Now, I'll show you a picture of a tower, that is a ziggurat, which is something that would be a later localized idea that took root in this part of the world, but the Tower of Babel would be something far more ambitious in what they were hoping to do than one of these ziggurats. But this is an immense undertaking for them to have made it. You know, you can see here that this took a lot of bricks here to make something along this line. Have no idea what the Tower of Babel looks like, because I have no idea how far it got along before God said, "Let's confuse them." Now in verse 4, they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." And so with these bricks, they planned to make a city and a tower reaching to the heavens in order to make a name for themselves. They were going to say, "We are someone special, and we are sedentary. We are going to be here in this place, and we're here for the long term." Now, building a city was not the problem. We've had cities that were mentioned earlier by some of the other people in some of the genealogies earlier in the book. Building a city wasn't what God was opposed to. It was all right for some people to stay here and others to move on. But they're trying to grow this city and prevent being scattered. Building a tower wasn't wrong. But the objective of the city and the objective of the tower is what God is objecting to. Notice how it says it in the text. "Let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered." They see this as a great unifying feature that is going to make it so that they are going to be a center of power that people will be attracted to, and that will prevent the being scattered. That's where the problem comes in. They were seeking to thwart what God had decreed back in Genesis chapter 9, 1. The scattering that was taking place was by God's design. Now, I put down as a note on the bottom of the page, Moses does tell us that they failed to build the tower as high as they proposed. Now, I don't know how tall they thought they had to be up in heaven. Have no idea. 100 feet, 200 feet, 500 feet. No idea how high they thought that it was, that they would have to get there. But Moses tells us that they didn't accomplish anything. You know where he does that? Next verse. Look at verse 5. But the Lord came down. The Lord was a lot higher than their tower. The Lord came down. Isn't that an interesting pun that occurs here? They failed to get a tower that was as high as God. You know, they wanted God to have to climb up to it. And God came down and had a look to see what was going on. I think that's a rather interesting turn of events. Well, in verses 5 through 8, we have God assessing what has happened and concluding with a response. Upon seeing man's efforts with the city and with the tower, God concluded that their plan had great evil potential. So he confused their language, resulting in them being scattered. Upon seeing man's efforts with the city and the tower, God concluded that their plan had great evil potential. So he confused their language, resulting in them being scattered. Let me just add a little footnote here. When we've said that the people were seeking to resist God's program of filling the earth by having people scattered, we're not told what God used to encourage it. But, you know, things like famine, pestilence, all sorts of things, supply and demand, not having enough food, having to move elsewhere in order to have food, God would use various natural means. But these people are rather determined, so God used a means that they had never counted on, making it so that they couldn't communicate with one another, which forced them to continue migrating, continue to accomplish what God had desired, and that was to fill the earth. So the first step, in verse 5, God investigated their efforts with regard to the city and the tower. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. God made an investigation. He determined, okay, let's see what's going on before I take a course of action. Well, in verse 6, he concluded that their plan had great potential for evil. Nothing evil was outside of their reach. They could do all sorts of very evil things. Now, if you think about it, why was it that God had brought the flood? It was because the potential was for the destruction of the human race. The destruction of the human race could have taken place if unchecked, the problem of the angelic infiltration had been allowed to continue. Likewise, if Ham's idea with the nakedness of his mother and making light of that, that could have had disastrous effects. God brought it to a swift conclusion. Here, God is looking and he's saying, they have the potential of creating another huge problem. That's when God determines he needed to respond. The statement about it having great potential for evil, we see in verse 6. The Lord said, indeed, the people are one. They're united. They're able to work together. They all have one language. And this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. You put enough people together and get them thinking about division of labor and start specializing and heading towards plans, and they're able to concoct all sorts of evil plans, and they have the capacity to bring about great evil. We had a saying with our boys, and that when we went from having one to having two that were toddlers, one is like none, two is like ten. And you look at the Tower of Babel and you have all sorts of people concocting plans, and it's possible for them to devise great evil. And so God said, let's make them spread out again. Let's make them cease to be able to accomplish what they're seeking. So the Lord determined to confuse their language, which would destroy their unity. Verse 7, come, let us go down, and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. Now, isn't it interesting how this process of confounding God uses as a point-for-point response to come, let us make bricks? Because Laban is turned around into Nabal, and it becomes to confuse. Point-for-point response that we saw in that chiastic structure. God needs to prevent them from understanding one another so that they cannot work together, so that they cannot accomplish the great evil that is set before them. In verse 8, confusing their language, the Lord scattered them across the earth, thwarting their plan. They no longer had a basis for unity. They could no longer make a great name for themselves when they are at cross purposes with each other and cannot communicate. Communication is the key to their power. God destroyed their communication. That caused them to scatter. So it says in verse 8, the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Isn't it interesting? They didn't want to obey what God said. They didn't want to be scattered. God scattered them. It's kind of interesting. You look in the early church, and the early church, people were accumulating in Jerusalem, and the church was getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And what happened? There was persecution that arose. Acts chapter 8, verse 1. And everybody got scattered. Kind of looked like people had lost sight of what the Lord had commanded in the Great Commission. They were supposed to scatter and tell other people. You know, our tendency is to like the status quo. You know, we get comfortable and we don't like to get moved around. We don't like change. Have to tell you a little bit about Grace Chapel. Grace Chapel is a place that has a lot of transition. We tend to get comfortable and we think about, oh, you know, we've got this nice group. But, you know, we have been involved in training people up in ministry, and that's a continuing process. We might not have a school attached, but you think about all the people that have been entrusted to our care that have been prepared and have been groomed for ministry. Think of all the people who speak from this pulpit and the people who go to places like Ukraine, Australia, elsewhere, and even out to that foreign country called Hemet. But we've got people who are very solid, understand that the guarantee of everlasting life is the heart of the message that Christ gives. They're serious about studying the Word, and that means that sometimes they find themselves in this place or in that place geographically. You know, the Lord's been in the business of disrupting us when we get really comfortable and kind of saying, okay, I'd kind of like for some people to go over here and minister and accomplish some of the things that I've got. Well, I don't know that all these people in Shinar were accomplishing all sorts of wonderful things for the Lord, but he definitely scattered them. And so then in chapter 11, verse 9, we have a summary statement that tells us that Babel is a testimony to God's scattering humanity by creating Babel. Now, it is kind of an interesting thing. The play on word between Babel, the name of the city, Babylon, and babbling is not an accidental one. Play on words does occur, and Babylon, Babel, is a testimony to how man has plans and God can turn those plans completely upside down. They were looking to make a name for themselves, and what happened? God made a name for himself, and they kind of look like the builders of the Titanic, don't they? They kind of look like they didn't accomplish very much. So verse 9 said, therefore its name is called Babel, because there the Lord Baaled, the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. God accomplished what he had decreed, even though man was saying, no, I'm going to go my way. We've already covered the linear genealogy of Shem that eventuates in Terah's birth. But it is a very interesting thing that we see in Genesis. The issue of life and death that's always presented, God is able to accomplish what he's aiming at. Man aims himself in a certain direction, and what happens? God's able to cause the original plan to happen. People get scattered. And the original plan of a pure line that's going to be able to eventuate in the seed of woman also eventuates. Every time we see God acting, God is able to turn that which man is ready to turn into chaos. He's able to restore it, and things go the direction that he's aiming. Genesis is showing us how much in control God is. He's able to accomplish in history what he desires. Moses is telling a people who are ready to enter the land of Israel after they are taken out of Egypt, and he's telling them, God made promises. He made promises to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And that same God who made those promises has been able to solve problems all the way and accomplish in history what he desires. Genesis is telling us very much that the God that Moses was proclaiming was a God who would deliver on his promises. And we think back to the very first promises. We have that promise of everlasting life. I'd like for us to look at an interesting commentary. We've looked at this before, but take a look at, in your New Testament, at the book of Titus. Titus chapter 1, Paul, a bondservant of God and an apostle of Jesus Christ, according to the faith of God's elect, that is, according to the faith, the content of faith that God's elect believe, that believers believe, and according to the acknowledgement of the truth which accords with godliness, in hope, that is, certain hope of eternal life, which God, who cannot lie, promised before time began, more literally, before the ages began. That first promise of everlasting life was made way back in the garden before the fall with that tree of life. God, who is always working towards accomplishing what he promised, which is what Genesis tells us about, Paul is able to make allusion that he commanded everlasting life even before the ages began, even before the fall, way back in the garden. There's an emphasis on life and death in the book of Genesis, and God is a God of his promises. That seed of woman promise, that promise of everlasting life, is something that God is very much in the business of delivering on, even though man keeps wanting to plunge himself into death and destruction and trying to thwart God's plan.